You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
This month we're going to start in our solar system as normal, and we'll go out to Jupiter, to Jupiter's moon Europa. So this is the icy moon that has been in the headlines an awful lot for having this icy shell, one of the iciest objects that we know, at least on its surface, but below which it's known, well, there's a lot of evidence that there is this ocean beneath the surface. And one of the really intriguing pieces of evidence for this in recent years has been the detection of these plumes of materials spouting out from the surface, normally seen as sort of snapshots rather than as a video of a plume appearing. But there's been some new analysis that says that instead of coming from the ocean and venting out, these might have a less dramatic origin, I guess, Edward.
Yeah, the reason that we're interested in Europa having oceans underneath its surface is because they could possibly harbour life. Although Europa is so far out away from the sun in the solar system, you'd imagine that the surface would be very, very cold, and it probably is. But if the ocean is below the surface, then it could be temperate and warm enough for it to be able to sustain life. And that's why it's really, really interesting that there are oceans or big bodies of water underneath the surface. The fact that there have been these plumes suggests that there has been liquid underneath the water that's escaping out, either through geothermal activity or, as this new study suggests, it could be that an impact from something cuts through the surface and melts some frozen sort of salty water or salty ice, and at some point later that then plumes. So it's very much a temporary body of water that's formed by this heating of something hitting the surface, like puncturing through a layer of salty ice in this model. Now, that's not to say that this is right. It's just, you know, another interpretation, and I don't know. The romantic in me doesn't want to believe it, because it wants to believe that there's an ocean underneath the surface of Europa that's teeming with sort of aquatic life. But it'll be a while before we can really tell.
I think the idea that there's an ocean there hasn't gone away. So the idea that there's still an ocean is still there, because you need that to explain some of the observations from spacecraft, to explain the density of Europa and so on. And you also need to explain the way the surface is moving around. So the surface of Europa looks like ice flows that are moving around, essentially, and they have to be moving around on something liquid. So the idea that there's an ocean there, we know that it's probably much, much deeper than was perhaps first thought, so tens of kilometers deep. Which does make these plumes seem kind of unlikely to, or very rare at least, to get an ice crack through, you know, tens of kilometres, maybe hundreds of kilometres of ice. But the exciting thing about it coming from the ocean is that we could essentially sample that water in the ocean without having to drill or melt down. We could just look at the stuff that's on the surface that's come up from the plumes. And you're right that the romantic side of this of not being able to then do that and just sampling bits of the surface, bits of that icy crust that have melted, is potentially slightly less exciting. But if that's all very salty, then that implies, if it's salty, it's because that water has been in contact with rock at some point. That's where you get the salt from in salty water. And so that implies that whatever's making that icy crust has been circulating and been in contact with rock. So there's still an awful lot of, it's still an interesting thing to do. And this is not a reason, as you say, it's not really confirmed, it's another hypothesis, but it's not a reason to not go and study in more detail.
Oh yeah, definitely. And also it's such an intriguing world that it would be crazy not to. And in fact, there's a NASA mission called Europa Clipper, which is scheduled to go and do this type of analysis. And really, it's going to be whereas 100 years ago people thought that that there was liquids and canals and things on Mars. Now we're thinking, well, there's not canals, but there is definitely some sort of liquid in other places in the solar system. I think it's really a scientific obligation to go and investigate them. Mm. Mm.
So hopefully we'll learn more when Europa Clip is gone. There may be more studies. This is the studies here are based on similar things that happen on the Earth and extrapolating those to what happens on Europa and doing theoretical models and so on. So the ground's truth is probably what's needed to actually nail this once and for all. Sticking with moons, but actually coming close to home, to sticking with our own moon, but also sticking with water. Now, water on the moon is not something you normally hear about. There have been previous experiments that have tried to figure out whether there are reservoirs of ice on the moon, and these are thought to be in these permanently shadowed craters. So near the north or south pole of the moon, there are craters that are deep enough that they just never see sunlight, so that there could be these deposits of ice that never melt. And there have been experiments in the past to fly spacecraft or rocket stages or whatever into the moon and look at the plume, a bit like Europa, look at the burst of material that comes out. And there's been a new measurement, but not from flying something into the moon. It's from an airborne observatory, SOFIA, this big telescope in the side of a 747, that has observed not a permanently shadowed crater, has observed a daylit bit of the moon, a lit bit of the moon that does get sunlight, to see whether there's evidence of water there, and indeed has found that there does seem to be water there. Now, not liquid water, not oceans of water or lakes of water. You're not going to, don't take your bathing suit to the moon, but there is water within the rocks. So to find out more, I wanted to speak to some real life lunar geologists. And so I spoke to two people from the University of Manchester, Marissa Lowe and Dr. John Pernay-Fisher, who work on lunar geology. The SOFIA spacecraft took these measurements of the moon. What has it shown us about the moon that we didn't know before?
It's discovered that there is molecular water on the sunlit surface of the moon. So as you said, there's been a few different pieces of this story beforehand, but this is the first definitive evidence that it's molecular water. And it's also a unique result in that it's on the sunlit surface of the moon. I think most results so far, when people are talking about water on the moon, are thinking about the polar regions in these areas called permanently shadowed regions, where, as the name suggests, the area is always shadowed, the sun is never on the area, you're never going to be melting this area, melting ice in the area.
Okay, so this one you said is the sunlit side, so you expect that the moon, the surface of the moon gets pretty hot in daylight, in sunlight. So that's the surprising thing to me, at least, to find water in the sunlit bits of the soil. To you as a lunar geologist, is that a surprise to you?
Yeah, definitely. So far, we have had a lot of data from different satellites. We had that data from the Cassini flyby back in 2004. Then there was also the Indian spacecraft Chandrayaan back in 2008, and both of those were getting information from the polar regions of the moon. Other than that, we have had a lot of information from samples, so from the different Apollo missions, mostly from samples of the lunar regolith. So from Apollo 15 and 17 in particular, they had a great number of these pyroclastic glass beads. So this is from explosive volcanic activity on the surface of the moon. They're tiny, tiny orange, black, green glass beads, which, because they were so small, when they were erupted, they quenched or dried very, very quickly. So they locked in different gases that were present in these lunar volcanic eruptions. So using different instruments on Earth, back in 2008, there was a very, very famous paper by Alberto Sal, which detected this molecular water in the samples. So obviously that was a very exciting result. And these pyroclastic glass beads are spread across the surface of the moon. But they're just one place where this water could be hosted. It could also be within the rocks, within the regolith, as we were saying before.
What form is this water taken? I mean, if I go to the moon with a straw and stick it into the rock, am I going to be able to have a drink?
It wouldn't be a very nice drink. So when we say that there's water there, to put it into perspective, SOFIA detected around 100 to 412 parts per million of water. So imagine if you had a box of a million little cubes or something, 100 to 400 of those would be water if we were thinking about the material on the moon.
So that's less than one in a thousand.
Yeah. And something that I saw earlier is that that's actually 100 times drier than the Sahara Desert. So even though we're saying, wow, there's water, it's definitely water, we know this now, there's still not very much of it, sadly. So there's a lot of planetary scientists who are now doing work on something called in-situ resource utilization, which would be methods for extracting this water and making usable amounts of it.
Okay. And so this is because the water's not in, we're not talking about puddles of the stuff, right? Or, you know, underground, you know, little rivulets or anything. This is not running water.
So it's not going to be bodies of water. It's going to be stored in void spaces between grains in the regolith. It could be stored in those pyroclastic glass beads that I was talking about before. So it's not going to be the case of we stick a tap in the ground and we can draw lots of water out. It's going to be more difficult. It's going to need more processing than that.
As we record this, there's due to be a launch tomorrow of a new mission to the moon. Chang'e 5 is a Chinese mission, which is going to go to the moon and collect samples. John, when you get a sample from the moon, what do you do with it?
Well, that's a good question. So I guess really, the world is your periodic table, really. So one of the main things that we like to do, or specifically that I like to do anyway, is look at the chemistry of the rocks that are brought back. And the chemistry of rocks are really important because they give us such a unique insight into the history of that sample. So not only can we understand how it's sort of been modified as a rock has been sat on the lunar surface, but also you can use other elements to try and understand how that rock was formed. And so in the case of a volcanic rock, we can understand what the conditions were like in, say, a magma chamber, or, you know, how lavas and melts sort of formed originally in the interior of the moon. So there's a huge amount that we can learn. And really, most of how we understand sort of very general processes, such as how the moon has formed, how has it evolved over geological time, boil really down to how we interpret the chemistry of all these rocks. So there's a huge amount of possibility that can be done with these samples that are due to be brought back.
So Chang'e 5 is going to go and get a small sample and bring it back. How does this sample size compare with what we have, or I think it's a couple of kilos. How does that compare with what we've got already from previous missions, mostly Apollo, of course?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in comparison, it's a relatively small amount. I mean, Apollo brought back, you know, hundreds of kilograms. And then supplementing that, obviously, we have meteorites that we think come from the moon. And, you know, they add probably a few more kilos to that total mass as well. But I mean, really, sample size is becoming less and less of an issue these days. I mean, back in the 1970s and 80s, you needed a lot more material to get good, robust measurements done on these samples. But actually, as analytical techniques develop over the ages and over the decades, we're getting much better at analyzing the chemistry of rocks using much smaller volumes. And so even though comparatively it's quite a small amount that's being brought relative to Apollo, we should still be able to get some really great data off these samples.
One of the reasons we're interested in this water is so we can use it for rocket fuel. How does one get water out of a rock? I mean, it sounds like getting blood from a stone.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an impressive sort of technical feat, I suppose. So it really relies on having particular minerals in there that you can use various sort of chemical processes to break them down. I think very specifically, it's a mineral called ilmenite that people use. And you can go through various sort of oxidization reactions. And I'm not quite sure what the precise sort of mechanism is to get from this, but you can effectively put it in this machine that will break it down into its constituent parts. And so you can extract things like oxygen and water. But you've got to have specifically the right sort of rock type. You can't just do that with any old lump of rock, unfortunately.
So it's not the equivalent of getting out a pestle and mortar on the kitchen table and grinding it down and getting a puddle at the bottom.
Yeah, no, not quite, I guess. Yeah. But it's, you know, this is something that was sort of theoretically thought of in terms of, like, in principle, could we do this in the sort of 70s and 80s? And then in the 90s, people had made on Earth some sort of large scale mock-ups of actually trying this process in labs that would take, you know, half the size of a room. So it's one thing doing it on the ground here on Earth, where we have the space and the luxury of being able to sort of lay these things out, but then trying to transfer that process onto the moon, that's going to be the real technical challenge in order to actually do this if we ever send people back to the moon.
So a miniaturization exercise, essentially, of a half the size of a room to something that's got to be the size of a Coke can or something, I guess, in the end.
Yeah, that and, you know, just being able to sort of troubleshoot these things when they go wrong. And, you know, I suppose you've got to put a lot of material in as well to get, you know, stuff that's useful. I mean, it's all very well in a lab producing half a cup of water, but, you know, you actually need significant quantities for it to be used as fuel or to be used for, you know, human habitation or whatever. And I guess it's the other challenge is how do you shift such large amount of lunar material through such a process to get something usable out the other end.
So if people want to find out more, they don't just have to listen to you here. They can hear yourselves and colleagues elsewhere as well. Tell us about your recent podcast endeavors.
Yes. So it was about a year and a half ago now. We started a podcast called The Cosmic Cast on Spotify and on YouTube. We talked to other UK academics and found out a bit more about planetary science that's going on in the UK. So it's a huge range of topics, really, from the moon to Mars to the gassy giants in the outer solar system. So if anyone's got a further interest in planetary science, yeah, do check that out.
Excellent. Sounds good. So Marissa Lowe and John Pernay-Fisher, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Edward, with Chang'e 5 having, I recorded that interview just before it launched. It has now launched and it's on its way to the moon. It takes, compared with most space missions, just a few days to get there, which is, you know, we used to think it took years to get out to Jupiter or Venus or whatever. It's a hark back to the Apollo days where these things just took days to get to the moon. And it's got to work quickly. It doesn't have, like Chang'e 4 does. Chang'e 4 has solar batteries and so on and heaters to keep it surviving in the night. Chang'e 5 hasn't. It's got one lunar day, which is you know, a couple of weeks, to get all its observations and launch back and send samples back to Earth, which is, you know, time is tight. They've only got one shot at this. But this is the first in a while, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, a sample return mission from the moon we haven't seen since the days of the Apollo, so that's the 70s, and in those days, you know, you send a person and they scoop up quite a lot, what was it, several hundred kilograms of so that's what, like a dozen people's worth of lunar material, and they ship it back and you've got a lot of things. But the interesting thing about Chang'e 5 is that it's going to places that we haven't sampled of the moon. So the Apollo missions went to the Mare in the highlands, and this is going to a volcanic area of the moon. And so it'll be interesting to see if the terrain is different, see if the regolith, that's the name of the Martian soil, the regolith.
The moon soil, even.
What did I say?
You said Martian.
Martian, yeah. Damn it. The regolith, it'll be interesting to sample the regolith, which is the name of the lunar top surface or the soil, and see whether it is different to the samples that have been obtained before with Apollo.
So certainly interesting to see the results. It comes back mid-December, I think. And so we'll get samples from there. And of course, it is actually the same kind of timing as Hayabusa 2, which is bringing its samples back from asteroid Ryugu as well. So a couple of sample returns in the same kind of time frame as well. So interesting results to come from there. Moving way outside the solar system, let's go to something we've talked about before on this program, fast radio bursts. These are bursts of radio waves, the name kind of suggests, that initially discovered a decade or so ago as coming from, somewhere unknown. They were just seeing this burst of activity, thought to be interference, lots of theories about what they could be, have now been seen to be repeating, have been located with some telescopes to various places out in the cosmos, normally in other galaxies. But we've now got one that's significantly closer. We've got a radio burst, a fast radio burst of radio waves coming from something in our galaxy, and that just means it's that little bit closer. We can just study it in a little bit more detail. And to boon, this is repeating as well. So I mean, this kind of thing, this is what you want from these, right, Edward? Close and repeating, so you can predict what it's from.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's like an astronomer's dream to have something interesting that you've been scratching your head over for a long time, and then you have something which is giving you predictable data, or it's data which you can obtain predictably, so you don't have to constantly be on red alert for new observations. And you can really study it with lots and lots of different telescopes and different wavelengths as well. Because although it's radio, there's also associated X-rays with these things. And actually, it's studying the other, not just the fast radio bursts, but the other electromagnetic signals from these things give you a much more complete picture of the physics that's going on. Now, in this particular case, it looks like a magnetar, which is a neutron star with an intense magnetic field that's flaring, and it's doing these flares with some regularity, and then the flare is smacking into something that's been thrown off from the star in its previous life that's sort of surrounding it. Some material like electrons and other particles, and then that you see that being transmitted as X-rays, and also you see some radio waves as well. And it's the flaring really that is the regular part of that. And it's actually really nice that there's something around there that's giving us this extra information.
I mean, that hypothesis about these being flares that hit this material going around, you know, somewhere some distance away from the central object is something that I know was talked about as a hypothesis when I've talked about these previously with researchers from the Chine telescope. But this is great to see, you know, more evidence and something that I suspect radio astronomers are now going to be keenly tuned into to see if they can pick out more and study this in much more depth. One telescope that would normally be doing that, I'm sure, is the Arecibo telescope, this massive dish in Puerto Rico that's been there for nearly 60 years. And very sadly, it now looks like that observatory, or that telescope rather, is going to have to close. So what happened is in the summer, there was a cable snapped, and then subsequent damage has led to a second cable snapping, and the situation may not be recoverable. At least it's a very unsafe place to go. Now, to find out more about the immediate situation there and what the plans were, I spoke to a graduate of Cardiff University who did his undergraduate and postgraduate studies here and then worked at Arecibo for a couple of years. So Dr. Rhys Taylor now works in the Czech Republic in Prague. And I spoke to Rhys and first of all got an idea for the scale of this enormous radio telescope.
It is an extremely impressive sight. I mean, I was working on site basically every day for over 2 years, and you never really quite get used to it. It's definitely large enough that it's hard to appreciate the scale unless you are lucky enough to see a small bird or something fly past it. And then you really realize, yeah, that is really, really large. And also the thing that I of course, like everyone else, it's certainly in my age group, grew up seeing it in GoldenEye and being absolutely convinced that this huge dish is made of concrete, which of course it isn't, because concrete wouldn't reflect radio waves. It's made of this very thin aluminium panels. So, but what that means that you don't see in the movies is that the dish from underneath is actually transparent, because each panel is mostly made of very small holes. So from above it looks nice and reflective and opaque, but underneath you can see straight through. But if you are standing above it, and on occasion you might see someone driving a car underneath the dish, and then you suddenly see this movement, which looks really quite surreal, because it looks like a perfectly solid metal surface, and then you suddenly see a car driving, and it looks really quite odd. But once again, you see this tiny little car way off in the distance, then you realize, yeah, that is a truly enormous structure.
And it's 300, or the main dish is 305 meters across. That's 1,000 feet to anyone who wants old money, as it were. So that's the kind of sense of scale, and it's built into a sort of natural depression in the ground.
Yeah, it's a natural sinkhole in this limestone cast topography. So I don't believe they had to do much reshaping to actually fit the dish in. The dish is actually effectively suspended above this sinkhole. So the height of the dish above the ground varies quite considerably. In some places near the edges, it's really just a few feet. down at the bottom, it's maybe about 10 meters or so, maybe a bit higher in other places. Underneath, of course, you still get flooding from all the rain. So there's a whole system of pumps which is continuously draining that out. And on occasion, that has stopped working. And then very rarely, but you do occasionally see it, that it starts to flood up to considerable height. Although it's never come on anywhere near the scale as in GoldenEye, where the entire thing is submerged, I am told that at one point it did once reach the bottom of the reflector, which would be a very strange sight to see.
Mm. The telescope is not just that big dish in the ground. The telescope also comprises the secondary mirror, so a second reflector, and that's got all the receivers and so on in them. And that is suspended pretty high above the ground.
Yeah, that secondary structure, the platform, weighs 900 tons. It's actually much larger than in terms of mass than the dish, which is around 300 tons, give or take. And that is also enormous. I mean, it's not just a secondary, it's a secondary mirror and a tertiary mirror. The reason for that is that the dish is spherical. It's not a nice parabola like you get in most radio telescopes, which will focus all the radio waves to a single point. The spherical surface actually focuses the radiation to a line. So one way of dealing with that is to have this line feed, which is the thing that Sean Bean falls off at the end of GoldenEye. But the other, which was much more recent, is this secondary mirror inside this ginormous dome, which is about the height of a four-story building, if I remember correctly. And that contains a secondary mirror, which is itself 25 meters in diameter, which is a very respectable size on its own for most radio telescopes. And that is a complicated shape, which then focuses things down onto a tertiary mirror, which is itself 12 meters across. So still quite a sizable structure. And that finally focuses it back into the receiver room, where there are various kinds of receivers which actually do all the fancy data processing. So this is, it's a very large structure. It contains many different rooms, most of them jam-packed with various electronic equipment. So it's something you can wander around inside in. It's not just like one small cabin suspended above the dish. It's really quite large. I believe it's about 127 meters above the surface of the dish, which gives you a good few seconds of free fall. If you were ever unfortunate enough to actually accidentally fall off, you would have just enough time to realize you've made a horrible mistake.
Well, let's not plan on doing that at all. Now, that secondary structure is suspended from, is it three towers around the edge?
Yeah.
That have a number of cables leading from them to that secondary structure. So a bit like a suspension bridge, except, of course, the bridge is very high. It's 100 meters above the surface of the dish. And it's those cables that have snapped. Now, these are not small cables, are they?
No, they're quite thick. They're roughly as thick as my arm, maybe slightly more even. They are enormous things. And, of course, you've got 900 tons pulling down on these. So the tension in these cables is enormous, and that helps to explain why one of these cables snapped. It ripped this 100-foot wide hole, I believe it was, in the surface of the dish earlier in the year, back in August. Some of the photos you might have seen on the press releases make this look very dramatic, and it looks like, when I saw that, I thought, oh, hell, this is really, really bad. But actually, when you see it from above, the damage didn't look that severe. So I was thinking, maybe this is not too bad. It's just a problem with the dish. Perhaps this can be repaired. But since this second cable snapped, it looks like the damage to the dish itself has even been worse. But the fact that this cable snapping actually shifted the platform, this 900-ton structure, well, you can get some idea of the forces that are involved in there, that you can actually move this structure just by snapping a cable. So you really do not want to be anywhere near those cables when that happens. And that's what's making it now so dangerous to work with.
The decision has been made that the thing is so unsafe, it's hard to even imagine trying to fix this, threading new cables in and so on. That the decision has been made to decommission it. Now, I know that there are no, as we're recording this at least, there are no decisions about how one even does that. And there were some kind of horrific suggestions of using explosive to essentially, blow things up so the thing just collapses, which sounds awful.
When the announcement came, it was really like a punch to the gut. It really does make you feel awful, because it's just such a wonderful instrument. It's such a valuable scientific resource. But at the same time, of course, if it's that dangerous, you cannot possibly ask people to risk their lives for it. That's just not sensible.
So that brings us on to Arecibo's contributions to science. I mean, as a very big radio dish, you don't see many of those. What are the advantages of having this enormous dish in the ground?
Sensitivity really is the main one. Sensitivity and resolution. And it gets a little bit complicated there because unfortunately, sensitivity is about more than sheer collecting area. So it's much more popular these days to build arrays of telescopes, like the Very Large Array in New Mexico, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array in Chile, which are dozens of very much smaller dishes. And of course, there are now SKA Pathfinder telescopes in South Africa and Australia. And these have the advantage of extremely high spatial resolution. So they can resolve very, very fine details in the objects that they're observing. And they do this by connecting these arrays of dishes together in a mathematically horrendous way. It's the mathematics behind it is absolutely horrible. I will not claim to understand that fully, I think. But somehow it does. And they are able to get absolutely beautiful, exquisite images of distant galaxies, which is something you really can't do with a single dish, because what they do is effectively form a telescope with a resolution equivalent to being a kilometer, 2 kilometers or larger across. So a really very large structure indeed. The penalty that they have for that is sensitivity to extended emission. Now, the reason for that is not just simply collecting area. The VLA has about 1/5 of the collecting area of Arecibo, but its sensitivity to the diffuse gas, for example, has been estimated around 700 times or even more less than Arecibo. And the reason is the way this interferometry is done. What you need to have this sensitivity to the really diffuse gas, which is actually some of the most interesting, is to have dishes which are as close together as possible. Now, with a single dish, you don't have this problem because effectively you have a series of dishes which are infinitely close together. So you can resolve structures on any scales. With interferometers, you can resolve the fine details, but you can't actually see the really large diffuse gas. So that is a severe penalty.
So Arecibo lets us see the diffuse wafting, wafting's the wrong word.
The really fluffy gas.
The really fluffy gas, excellent. And that's in distant galaxies and nearby galaxies or even in our galaxy as well, right? That stuff is yeah. Everywhere in the universe.
Yeah, and when I was doing my PhD, it was sort of common knowledge that actually if you went to the really faint stuff, then it would all just be ionized and you wouldn't be able to detect it. But that's turned out really not to be the case. There are galaxies with these very diffuse structures, and it's good because the more extended the gas is, the more evidence you see of galaxy interactions. So it's easier to see disturbances in this really faint gas than it is in the higher density stuff, which the interferometers are sensitive to.
How much is the loss of Arecibo going to affect that kind of science?
Yeah, until actually about the middle of the summer, it was working more or less normally again. The survey that I'm involved in, we had about 1 week left of observations that we needed to finish it all, which we started this survey back in 2006. We were a week away from finishing it, and then the living hurricane hit. But in fact, that doesn't really matter too much because we got so much data that this last few nights won't really make any difference. The loss to astronomy in general, I think, is quite serious. There are replacement facilities coming online in some degree. I mean, there are these Pathfinder telescopes in South Africa and Australia. There is the Chinese telescope, this FAST, which is the nearest equivalent to Arecibo. But there's really nothing that does all the things that Arecibo could do. There's nothing comparable for the atmospheric studies. And Arecibo was one of only two facilities which had this capability to do radar observations of near-Earth asteroids and other objects in the solar system. The only other one is in Goldstone, I believe it's in California. So there, that really does limit what's possible because the Arecibo transmitter was very much more powerful. It's when you stick a half a megawatt transmitter on a 300 meter dish, you get an enormous magnification of that signal.
And that's because radar involves, of course, beaming radio waves at things. It's not just listening for radio waves. It's actually sending stuff back.
It's actually active. So instead of just listening for stuff or receiving information, you can actually, to a very limited extent, affect the thing that you are trying to survey. So normally in astronomy, when you commission a telescope, you talk about first light, when you get the first light that's been collected. Always thought that for radar, they should talk about first zap, because you actually do zap the asteroids with a very powerful radio transmitter. doesn't really affect the asteroids in any way, of course, but you do get a signal bounce back off them.
And so the loss of the ability to do that will affect our ability to study asteroids. And as you say, that diffuse emission of gas in the universe near and far will affect our ability to study that in more detail. Rhys Taylor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So, Edward, I mean, Arecibo is it's an iconic place, right? There's a lot of people saying, come on, you should find the money. You know, surely no cost is too much to save Arecibo. At the moment, as I understand it, there is currently no way they can save it without endangering people's lives, because it's just so unsafe. It could go at any moment, and when it goes, you don't want to be anywhere near it. I think people have talked about getting the army or the air force involved with heavy lifting gear and so on, but this is something that's 900 tons. You know, it's a 4-story building size thing. It takes more than just one little helicopter to lift that, I imagine. So it will be a serious feat of engineering, and I suspect was not designed to be, as far as I understand, was not designed to be lowered to the ground. Once it was lifted up, it was there for good.
Yes. Yeah. And that's actually one of the interesting things about it, is that unlike almost every other telescope, it can't be moved. So for astronomy purposes, you can't point it at a particular part of the sky. You basically have to wait until the thing that you want to study is directly overhead, or more or less directly overhead. And then you just study it while it's there. And then the next thing comes along. And you just rely on the rotation of the Earth and the Earth moving around the sun. And that really is how you slew that telescope.
Now, of course, if they decommission the telescope, there's something that happens with decommissioning telescopes, normally in one of the agreements between the observatory and the government, whoever owns the lands that it's on, is that when the telescope is decommissioned after what's now 60 years, but however long these things are around, it is returned to its original state. And so that means that decommissioning a telescope, regardless of whether they have to use explosives to demolish it or they lower something safely to the ground, that's a huge operation.
Yeah, it's something that people don't think about when building observatories. Actually, the cost of decommissioning can often be far higher than the cost of building it initially. You don't have the running cost anymore, but you still have a huge chunk of money to basically destroy the this thing that has brought so much science to the world. Mm.
Now, maybe if they do manage to decommission it in a safe and controlled way, in that they don't have to blow anything up, that it can be left as a monument or a visitor center. I'm sure there's reasons for it to be a visitor center. I know it's a big tourist attraction in Puerto Rico, so a huge loss to the astronomy community. Well, that sad note brings us to the end of this month's episode. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk, and you can also find us on Spotify. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.